some 3,000 years ago, a certain queen from the Central Africa heard about the wisdom of the king of a small kingdom in the Middle East. She traveled up to his kingdom, saw his wisdom, and paid him tribute. Then, before leaving, she converted to his strange religion. She became pregnant by him, and then she returned home. When she returned home, she became the mother of a dynasty that ruled for nearly 3,200 years. Some 1,200 years after this queen lived, an official in her kingdom was visiting this same strange land. On his way home, he converted to an offshoot of their common religion and brought that offshoot of the religion back home to his people. The people, they converted, and then that dynasty ruled until 1974, with the fall of the Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. The queen, of course, was the Queen of Sheba, and the king was King Solomon. And the eunuch today in charge of the treasury, he was that court official that we read about in Act 8. When I was looking at the reading today, I knew that I was going to talk about the history of the church in Ethiopia. And I knew that because it's so fascinating and ancient. Because some 1,200 years before... Oh, we got it. Good. It was going to be less interesting without the pictures. So 1,200 years before the coming of Christ, the kingdom of Ethiopia actually converted to Judaism. So they were already familiar with Judaism for 1,200 years before Christ even came. They established ties with Jerusalem, and they even came up to the temple to worship, as is required by the law. What's also interesting is not only did the Ethiopian Empire outlast the kingdom of Israel, but it also became a Christian nation before the Roman Empire became a Christian nation. And even the Christian community in Ethiopia even predates the Christian community in Rome by about 25 years. And that community in Rome is where most Western churches trace their roots back to. According to the tradition of Ethiopia, the eunuch returned to Ethiopia, and shortly thereafter, the entire nation converted to Christianity. Today, Ethiopia has a rich tapestry of that history and traces their Judeo roots back to the Queen of Sheba. On our far left here, on the far left here, we have a church. It's 1,000 years old, and it was carved out of the rock, out of the bedrock. And it's been in use as a church for over 1,000 years. On the far right, that's a monastery that's been in continuous operation in Ethiopia for over 1,500 years. And in the center, most interestingly, is a small chapel where a single monk devotes his life in the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ethiopian church believes that they actually possess the Ark, and it resides in that small chapel with a single monk devoting his life to the upkeep of the Ark. Because of that rich history, and I'm going to mispronounce this, the Ethiopian Tewahedo churches each possess a copy of the Ark, and once a year they parade that Ark around. The story of Philip and the eunuch is also very similar to another ancient story about the Christian Church of India. Thomas the Apostle traveled to India in about the year 50 CE, so about 15 to 20 years after the death of Christ. And he preached to the Indian communities there. In some traditions, he was actually snatched away from where he was and taken to India, much the same way Philip was brought to the Ethiopian eunuch. In India, Thomas founded 7 house churches, and he was eventually martyred, and his tomb is located in Mylapore, India, on the southwest coast of India. So, and on the left here, we actually have the tomb of Thomas the Apostle. And then on the right, I just found this very interesting. This is a church that's been in continuous occupation since 977 AD in India. From those churches, from those 7 house churches, there is a Christian heritage that exists down to this day. The churches are referred to by several different names, most commonly the Syriac or the Syro-Malabar churches. And though many of the churches are Catholic, they have a unique liturgy that incorporates ancient Aramaic even. So, at this point, I have a little confession here. When I saw the reading, I was like, I'm definitely preaching on I'm going to give a little history of some ancient churches that, you know, are vastly, vastly different from our own. But I had no idea how that related whatsoever to what our series is, which is on the abundance, right? And the reason why I wanted to do that is because the history of Christianity is not only one of my favorite topics, but it's so much more interesting and fascinating than we often hear about. And especially the Church of Ethiopia, because it's not just older than the Church of Rome, which is a community that we trace our roots to. But it's also vastly different in teaching than our own. And regardless of whether or not the history of the Ethiopian church is 100% historically accurate, we do know that the history of Judaism dates back 3,200 years in Ethiopia, and we do know that the history of Christianity dates back 2,000 years in Ethiopia. And it all started with conversion of the Queen of Sheba in the time of Solomon. And it's just cool that they think they have, that they believe that they have the Ark. I mean, that's just really cool. And that a single monk devotes his life to the presence of the Ark. But that's not really a sermon. And that has nothing to do with our topic. So when I started thinking about this, I actually was not sure what I was going to do. So I said to John, I have some ideas about what I want to do. I want to do something about mission. I'm going to talk about ancient Ethiopia. I'm going to talk about the ancient churches of India. But I'm kind of stuck there. And so he and I started talking, and it struck me that there is an abundance that we're talking about here. And it's the abundance of the experience of the church. The abundance of experience in our churches is what we are discussing when we talk about these stories. Flash forward to the 14th century. There was a monk. His name was Thomas Aquinas. He decided he wanted to write a summary of everything that the church taught at the time. And so he wrote a book. It's called the Summa Theologica. And in that book, he summarized everything that the church taught. And he married it with 2 particular philosophers. They were Greek philosophers from about 200 years before the coming of Christ, Aristotle and Socrates. And it was considered one of the, it still is considered one of the greatest works of theology of all time. And for better or for worse, within 200 years, by the time of the Reformation, the Summa Theologica was the book that the church used to teach theology. And they considered it the absolute, total, final word on everything related to the church. And that work had a profound influence on the churches, on the Western churches, even our own, down to this day. And in some respects, it even influences how we read the Bible itself. Since that time, since the time of Aquinas, the church has sent out missionaries who are taught that the Bible is the way to teach those who haven't known Christ. And they've also used their own cultural lens to filter how we read the Bible. And when we read the Bible, not only are we filtering it through our cultural lens, but we're also looking at it through the lens of two Greek philosophers, neither of whom had even heard of Judaism, let alone Jesus Christ. And, you know, the way we view that was so ingrained in the churches that the ancient Indian church that existed by 50 CE, by 50 years, or, you know, 20 so years after the death of Christ, those Indian churches were nearly extinguished altogether, even though they were just as old as the Western churches. And the Ethiopian church, which was even older than the Western church, was suppressed. Oh, too far. So this is what we have. I stole this from John, so if you really like it, all the credit goes to John. So the red there, that is the church, right? That's the one church. This is the church that exists in all time, the church to which Christ is the head. We then filter that church, right, through Western culture and experience. And at the end, what we have is an expression of church, right? Those are the churches that we attend. That can be the UCC, that can be the Catholic Church, that can be the Methodist Church. But it's the idea that it's the expression of an individual church. So then we go out and we do mission work. Go ahead. And when we start our mission work, what do we start with? We start with our expression of the church. And then we go into a culture that's not our own. And we try to express our expression of the church through their mission, or through their culture and their experience. Go ahead. But maybe we also go, well, you know, we're not the final version of the church, so we say, okay, there's some element of the church that exists beyond our own church. But to explain it to them, then we also use our Western culture and experience, and then what do we end up with? Something that's not clear, something that's brown, something that maybe looks like an expression of church. Yeah, but honestly, we're not sure, because it doesn't reflect either our Western culture and experience, nor does it reflect their culture or experience. And it's difficult when you're going through those filters of church, of what it means to be church, it's difficult for cultures who have never heard or never experienced our Western culture to actually incorporate that into their own cultural experience. So the abundance of experience that we're talking about today isn't the abundance of my experience, it's not the abundance of our shared experience, but it's the abundance of the experience of the church as a whole. And so maybe our mission today looks different from what we think it is. Maybe our mission today is to go into those ancient churches and say, what does their expression of church look like that's so different from our own, that has different cultural norms, different cultural expressions, is oftentimes based on different life philosophies of our own church? And how was that expressed? Because through that, we can understand what our own mode of thinking is, and we can begin to discuss what are the common elements of church. And maybe the discomfort we feel by listening to these churches will inspire our own missionary spirit. I already said that. So I have a few questions. There's nothing right or wrong here. And honestly, I don't know that there is some answers, but I want us all to struggle with some questions. First, how does the experience of the unchurched in America today differ from my own experience? What are some ways that people who are now in the second generation of being unchurched or even de-churched, what are some ways that they experience the church differently from me? What is their experience of church? Yeah, maybe the odd wedding or funeral. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Joni and I went to a church, to a wedding last weekend. It was fantastic. It was an Italian family who was holding on to Italian traditions, but in a completely a-religious way. There was not a single Bible verse read. It was an odd experience, right? Like, that's not normal for us, at least, right? I mean, Joni and I at our wedding, we had, you know, it was kind of in the context of a traditional church service.
And going along with it, I was literally in shock at the wedding reception afterward. We had this big fancy meal, and no one said a blessing. I'm not over it yet today.
Yeah. same here. So we at the same wedding, at the reception, there's no blessing. Because why would you have a blessing? By the same token, Joni and I also went to a very close one of my college roommates' wedding, and I was asked to say a blessing. And you know, they're not religious, and they're pretty. Their families aren't very religious. Like, what does a wedding blessing look like when it's not specifically religious? You know, it's a different experience. It's also a different experience, by the way, from my own experience, to try to give that and try to go with some theological themes, maybe, so that people hear those theological themes about marriage and what marriage can be, without specifically going down a religious route that you know is just going to fall on deaf ears. So one other thought that I had was media. You know, the experience of church that people might get is strictly filtered through the media. Some of that media is good, some of that media is bad. You know, so, for example, what happened in Pittsburgh might be really the first time somebody's really thought about the Jewish experience in America and what that might mean. Next question. In the United States today, where are the cultures where the church isn't present? Where are some cultures in the United States where the church isn't present? When you say it, you mean... Okay. So what Chuck is saying for those in the back is when he was a kid, on Good Friday, the churches were closed noon to three, Easter, Christmas.
Business,
not churches. Did I say churches? Sorry.
Churches are open.
Churches are open. on those days. Businesses were closed on Christmas, Easter, Good Friday from noon to 3. And now those businesses are open. And on Sundays. Right? But what are some cultures in the United States, specifically cultures, where the church might not be present? One that I think of is the GLBTQ community. The church is so often not present to that community. And honestly, the church doesn't know how to oftentimes be present to that community. You know, churches oftentimes have differing opinions or teachings or Bible verses that they go to when they think about the LGBTQ community. And so the church has a difficult time being present to those communities. And because the church isn't present in those communities, the church has a hard time speaking to those communities. If I were to go into that community today, or let's take any specific church, let's say the Catholic Church, which teaches that homosexuality is a sin and wrong. How might the Catholic Church be different if they were actually to go first to those communities and be present to them first? They might ask them to confess their sins. Is there any other cultures we can think of where the church isn't present? Neo-Nazis. No, that's excellent. That's excellent. The church is not present in neo-Nazi communities. I would also say, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did those communities spring up out of a lack of presence of the church? Or do they exist outside of the presence of the church because they choose to? True. We also have other bigots who, you know, strongly cling to Christian faith. I mean, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Protestant churches in particular used the Bible as a backstop against slavery and all manner of treating people of who weren't Western European just awful. I also would say another place where the church is not present is predominantly among people my age and younger. I have many, 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 many friends, obviously, who are my age, who have no experience of the church, or have had a bad experience of the church and not attended since they were teenagers. So maybe that's another culture. There's a young culture where the church isn't present today. The last question. Why so close to home? Is the church not present in these cultures? I don't think there's an answer here. I don't think there's an easy answer. I don't think we're going to find an answer here today. But why is the church not present in these cultures? In leadership team, Pastor John has brought up this idea of fresh expressions of church. And the idea of this fresh expression is to create church for the unchurched and dechurched. And when we discuss it, the idea isn't necessarily to bring the unchurched or dechurched into our churches, but the idea is to really recognize and reclaim what it means to be church. And maybe a wide variety of ways. One way, one interesting way that this fresh expression came out was, was it a fast food restaurant that they met? Does anybody? Yeah. So a group met at a fast food restaurant on a Sunday, and they would order their meal, and then they would sit at, you know, combine a bunch of tables together. Then they would sit and read, and it started off with a fairly small number. Maybe six, and the picture that we saw of that was, you know, probably in the upper teens, maybe in the 20s, of people who had just saw this, dropped in, and started to listen intently to what was being said. Did that look anything like what we might recognize as church? Nope. It's not something I might recognize as being church. But was it church? Yeah. And I think that's what Thomas and Philip, particularly today, have to teach us about what our filters of church are and what it means to be church. Because they were taken, both of them were taken out of their current location, their current comfort zone, and taken to something entirely foreign from themselves. And they went with nothing. They had no money, no food. It didn't require anything from them. They didn't even have time to think about, like, the normal logistics of what we might think of when we go on a mission. Even Paul, when he would think about a mission, if you think about the letters of Paul, how long did it take Paul to plan his mission trips? He would write letters and say, I need money, I need money, I need money for my mission trips. Philip? No, no. He was taken by God from one place and sent on a mission. And God just said, be present. Be the church to these people. And all they brought with them was their abundance of the experience they had of the risen Christ. So looking again at the story of Philip, we see some interesting things. First of all, Philip runs up to the chariot. And when he does that, he asks the eunuch a question. He doesn't start with preaching. He says to the eunuch, can I minister to you? Do you understand what is being read, what you're reading? Secondly, the eunuch invited Philip into that chariot. That chariot is also a very important place because in that chariot, that's a royal space. You cannot come into that space without being invited. To do so would be a criminal act. You would be killed for it. But there's also something very important about that. Philip can't begin until he's invited into that space. And only after he is invited can he begin to teach the eunuch. And finally, when the eunuch is prepared by the teaching of Isaiah and Philip, there's only one thing necessary for his conversion, and that's the water for baptism. I think in this moment, Philip joined in church with the eunuch. In creating that church with the eunuch required only three things. Two people, because Christ said, where two or more are gathered in my name, there I will be among them. Number two, an intent listening to the word. They started with Isaiah. And finally, a willingness to hear the message, because Philip could not begin until he was invited. I have some more questions that we can struggle with. What does it look like to be invited to a culture that's not my own? It's uncomfortable. What was that? Scary. It's scary to go to a culture that's not our own. Yeah, it's a fear of the unknown. A fear of the unknown. What are some preconditions to be invited to a culture that's not my own? I can't be invited if I'm not already present. So I have to be physically present before I can actually be invited to participate. That's also scary. Questions of whether or not you're going to be accepted. Yeah. It's a dichotomy, right? Like, we have to be present in order to be invited. But we can't wait to be invited to be present. A willingness to go. We have to be willing to go. Next question. What's necessary for church? People. Where two or more are gathered in my name. People. What else do we need? It sounds problematic back there. I would say the word. The word is always necessary. I find it interesting, though, also when I say that, when I was in graduate school in Minneapolis, or outside Minneapolis, there was a church nearby that was specifically a church for the unchurched. And they would always have, they would structure it kind of like a Catholic service, but not really, but kind of. And they always had three readings, which is a very Catholic thing. The first one was always an Old Testament reading. The second one was always a modern philosophy, modern science reading. So Einstein was a frequent pick, or Deschardins, who's a French philosopher. But they would pick something that wasn't specifically Christian, and then they would always read the gospel. And then they would tie all of that in because they felt it important, so that people would understand that all of science, all of philosophy, all of arts is directed towards God. And so they would actually struggle with these sort of things. What are some other necessary elements? Welcoming. I think that's good. We have to be welcoming. We have to be willing to receive. We also have to be willing to give. Whether that's the message, our time, right? We have to be welcoming. Is there anything in the church building that we would consider necessary for church? An altar? What do you mean by an altar? Christian looking. So, yeah, the restaurant didn't have an altar. They did have table, and they did have fellowship around the table. So is it the altar, or is it fellowship that we're really asking about? Fellowship, yeah. I think that's important, right? Fellowship is really mandatory for being church. Trust? Trust. Excellent. We have to trust the people that we're in fellowship with, or else we can't be in true fellowship with them. I would say a sense of ritual. A sense of ritual is necessary to be church. But I don't think that has to take a form that we would necessarily recognize as our own ritual. I think certainly the people who met at the fast food restaurant had a specific ritual that they followed that to them put them into the holy place. So I would say ritual is important. My son is falling apart, so I'm going to speed it along here. Sorry. Next question. What do I need to do to prepare myself to speak to a people who are unfamiliar with my culture? Yeah, we have to have an understanding of what we're talking about. I had a teacher, her name was Sister Susan Wood. She sat on the group that had talks between the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church in order to kind of bring those two churches closer together. And she said the most important thing that the people who sat on those two bodies or on that body was to recognize what their own religion was. So we have to recognize our own religion. We have to recognize the very truth about what we're preaching. Acceptance of right. We have to start by accepting their culture for what it is. Has anybody ever seen the movie? It's called The Mission. The Mission. It's from the 1970s. It's about the Catholic Church, a mission in Brazil, and this priest is sent into kind of the backwoods of Brazil to a tribe that has never had any real contact with the Western world. And he's there for several years enculturating himself. So before he can even speak to the people, he has to know what their culture is and accept their culture. And only then can he actually begin to speak to them. And also, you know, that's tied in a little bit with language, but a lot to do with what are their customs and just accepting those customs for what they are. Anything else? Yeah, to be open-minded, to listen to what the people are saying, because only once you listen do you understand what their needs are. I'd say that's critically important. You have to go in with a willingness and a recognition not to change what the culture is, but to change how you view the message of Christ through that cultural lens. I want to end today with a personal story about culture and faith, about my own. So I grew up in a culture where religion was very important. All my friends' friends, everybody belonged to the church. Everybody actually went to Catholic school. But it was kind of like this distant and personal intellectual view of God. I think that's pretty common, or was pretty common in the 70s and 80s. Kind of had two groups, either the cold, distant, and personal intellectual God, and then there was kind of the reaction against that for people who are very into like the Jesus movement. So I fell on that on the side of the intellectual group. In my late teens, I went through some pretty difficult struggles. And during a particularly difficult part of those struggles, I strongly believe that God spoke to me in a very, very real, tangible way. But because of my cultural expectations of a cold, distant God, I didn't tell anybody about this for nearly a decade. Much, 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 much later, I started to share that experience with people. And they would always be interested, like, what is that like? Like, you know, what would it be like to have God actually speak to you? And I said a few things. Number one, it was like the loudest thing I'd ever heard. But yet there was no sound. And they would say, well, what did God say to you? I said, you know, it's so clear in my mind. It is so clear what God said. And here's how I interpret what God said. You know, when you think about that, like, you know, I think of an old monastic story that God has only ever spoken one word, and that's love. And yet, the way in which that love is imparted even takes personal form in Jesus Christ. You know, like, so it's the word love, but the way we hear it is so different, each one of us, right? And so I would interpret it. And it was only, you know, several years after I started sharing it, I picked up a book, and it was, part of the book was talking about somebody who had actually, had actually spoken to God or had God speak to them. And they were describing this, and it was so funny because it was like reading my own experience. You know, it was like, oh, you know, like when God spoke, it was the loudest thing I'd ever heard, you know. And yet, there was no sound. There was nothing to hear audibly, but it was so loud. And the words were so crystal clear. And yet, you know, this is the way I interpret them. And I found that interesting even as I read it. Because it was so similar to my own experience, but it was so different from that lens that I'd grown up with that was so intellectual and so distant. And so since then, I've shared that experience a number of times with many people, oftentimes only after I felt that the invitation was open to talk about that. And every time I discuss it, it opens up some pretty profound discussions about who God is, about what faith means, and about what I believe about God, about Jesus Christ. And that only happened because I finally took the step and saw Jesus through a cultural filter that was not my own. I want to close with a prayer. God, renew in us a missionary spirit filled with zeal for you. Help us to speak into cultures that are not our own. Help us to be present to people who do not know you. Finally, God, we ask you, help us to be open to the things that we are not comfortable with and understanding of the things we do not know. We ask this through our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.